Back, everyone. Today's first speaker of the afternoon session will be Avery Brodick, who will discuss new results from the Event Horizon Telescope.
All right, well, thank you, and thank you for having me. There we are. So, I think last November we had a bona fide, big budget, cinematic astrophysical event. And many of you might recognize this picture from Interstellar. And I thought that movie was truly remarkable for at least two reasons. The first is, it's the first time in my knowledge that astrophysical accuracy was a selling point for a big-budget Hollywood film. So I can only assume that means the Waterloo community is rubbing off on Hollywood, and this is a harbinger of things to come. The second reason why that's remarkable is because this iconic picture from the movie that was included in all of their press releases really only presages our astronomical reality by about a year. Because as soon as next spring, the Event Horizon Telescope is going to produce images of the black hole at the center of the Milky Way that look something like this, exhibiting the shadow of the black hole. And this afternoon, I'm going to tell you a little bit about how that's being done, and how these images are going to tell us things about high-energy astrophysics and the fundamental physics of gravity. Now, before I get into all of that, you know, why should you stop what you're doing right now and start working on EHT science? Well, firstly, you shouldn't. You should wait till the end of the talk. But, you know, the real answer is black holes are cool, and that's even a bad physics pun. Funding agencies like more substantial answers, and those exist too, but it depends on whom you ask. Here's a picture of a prototypical quasar, 3C273. It's an accreting supermassive black hole, and it's enormously bright. Okay, and it could easily be an order of magnitude brighter. This kind of object, which is powered by accretion, and most of this luminosity is coming out very near the black hole horizon on scales measured in Schwarzschild radii, doesn't just outshine its galaxy, but it outshines its galaxy's 99 closest friends. Okay, so these are enormous amounts of energy being released right near the black hole. Many of you may have already noticed this feature here. That's not an imaging artifact. That's a relativistic, highly collimated outflow, Lorentz factors of order 10, again, originating very near the black hole. And we see these in a variety of objects. Here's a nice radio image of another one. There we are again. And they extend over intergalactic distances with the current scale holder, or record holder, extending over 4.5 megaparsecs. For reference, that's four times the distance between galaxies like the Milky Way. Okay, so these are truly intergalactic phenomena coming from very near the black hole itself. And these are not without consequence. Here's an image that shows both radio lobes and the intercluster gas, and you can see how the jets are carving out material and therefore ruling the fate of the galaxies they inhabit. So, if you're an astronomer and you want to understand why the night sky looks the way it does, why we see the kinds of correlations between black holes and their host galaxies, then you must understand the physics of gas interacting with black holes on horizon scales. Of course, we're in a physics institute, and I think the motivation for studying black holes in a physics institute is really all about strong gravity. And what I mean by strong gravity is the proper general relativist definition, m over r of order unity, where everything has gone terribly nonlinear. And there's only two places in astronomy where you can really study this. The first is on very, very large scales. This is just the Friedmann equation in twiddles. Okay, and that just tells you that a cosmologist had better know his general relativity. And I think this is a point that deserves to be belabored. You know, the past 20 years of precision cosmology have seen a number of remarkable discoveries. And chief among them is that you and me and all the stars in the sky are just the flotsam and jetsam on a dark sea, to borrow a phrase from yesterday. And in a very real sense, that's the price of general relativity. And you can just imagine if a young German scientist came to you today knowing this, that this is the price of GR, and says, "Have I got a theory of gravity for you? You just have to invent 95% of the universe." you might be a little suspicious. Of course, we don't give up on GR because it also passes in a number, enormous number of other tests, all the way from galaxy cluster scales down to orbital scales around the Earth, as well as even laboratory scales. So the enormous success of general relativity and this wide variety motivate us to keep it around, even in the face of this 95% price. The only other place that we can go off and study this highly nonlinear, strong gravity is around compact objects. And I'm going to focus on black holes. There, what do we know? Well, nearly nothing. So this is a picture of one of these ancient maps where the Mariner has filled in the space that they don't see with monsters and dragons. It turns out that those were actually based upon reports from sailors. These aren't really just monsters and dragons. And physicists do exactly the same thing. We start what we're familiar with, we extrapolate. You might recognize that. That's a gravistar, and this one over here is a firewall. The boring crustacean that we're all familiar with is a black hole, of course. But we're doing the same thing. And extrapolation in science is a four-letter word, so I'd like to emphasize that this is all a voyage of discovery. All of these questions could easily be resolved if we could only resolve the image, or resolve the region around black holes. Resolve their vicinity. We could probe this strong gravity's impacts on the astrophysics, and we can probe the space-time directly. So why hasn't that been done before? Well, because black holes live up to their billing as compact objects. Even the most massive are exceedingly small in astronomical terms. And so, for example, the black hole at the center of the Milky Way has a typical scale of about 50 microarc seconds in the images. And it turns out that that's the largest one in angular terms on the sky, the next one being M87, which comes in about 80% as large. Okay, so 50 microarc seconds, that's the target if you want to make images of black holes. That doesn't mean that we know every potential target. There's a new class of black holes out there, the ultra-massive black holes, more massive than 20 billion solar masses. And the first closest example of that would be quite close to this line. So there's always hope of finding additional sources. But again, 50 microarc seconds, that's the number to keep in mind. And this is not something that even the latest and greatest optical telescopes are going to do. Fundamentally, telescopes are diffraction limited, and things like Keck, even after their adaptive optics are included, can only see things of order 20,000 microarc seconds. They normally don't quote their resolutions in those units. Canada has recently joined the 30-meter telescope, which promises to be a boon for optical astronomy, but for event horizon physics, it's a complete bust. Okay, same story. So how are we going to do this? The answer is we really need much larger telescopes. But fortunately for us, radio astronomers have been doing this for many years now, building telescopes the size of the Earth using a technique called very long baseline interferometry. Their signals at two telescopes separated by large distances allow you to probe scales that are not limited by the size of the individual telescopes, but limited by the distance between them. And regularly, they've been able to access scales of order 100 microarc seconds, which is within spitting distance of our 50. And that brings us to the Event Horizon Telescope, which is essentially pushing this kind of technique to shorter wavelengths. Making the Earth bigger is expensive, but moving to millimeter wavelengths is possible. And that's what the EHT is, the Event Horizon Telescope is. It's an Earth-sized millimeter, very long baseline interferometer, consisting of existing telescopes. So it's leveraging the enormous investment in millimeter astronomy over the past decade and can access resolutions of order 10 microarc seconds. So we can put multiple pixels across kind of typical image we might expect. Now, I used to have to show a slide like this that would say how many additional stations you could in principle add based on what telescopes were available. But now, as of this past winter, I get to show you a slide that talks about all the stations that have been added. Successful millimeter VLBI experiments have been performed at the South Pole, at ALMA, and at the Large Millimeter Telescope in Mexico, three extremely important elements for the EHT, as well as telescopes in Europe, the URM 30-meter dish and the Plateau de Burr Array. So the EHT has essentially been completely filled in. And that means that right now it's on the cusp of being able to produce images. And the reason why filling it in was so important was that interferometers effectively measure the Fourier transform of the image, not the image directly. And any pair of telescopes fills in only a subset of the spatial frequency space, shown in one dimension here and in two dimensions there. And as you add stations, you fill in increasingly large regions of the spatial frequency space, and then you have a complete set of information from which to construct an image. And by image, I really mean image. We've simulated the process from an input all the way to producing an output image. And the bottom line is comparing these two. This is what we started with, and this is what we got out. So I fully expect next year, or at the latest, the year after that, to see pictures like the one on the right. This doesn't matter, or it doesn't depend upon the image morphology. Here's a completely different kind of source. And again, high-fidelity image reconstruction. Now, once we have that image, that will be wonderful. But that's not really what we're going to do the science with. EHT is not a one-trick instrument. It's not designed simply to produce an image. There's an enormous number of data types, highly granular data types, that it's going to produce. The first is a variety of sets of possible interferometric data types, things like the magnitudes of the Fourier transforms of the image, phase information about the Fourier, about the image, and combinations which are insensitive to details of the observation process. But all of these can also be produced for every polarization type, okay? So the full complement of the Stokes parameters. And they can be produced at multiple frequency windows. The first higher frequency experiments, all of the things I'm going to talk about today come from 230 gigahertz, but the first higher frequency experiments are slated for next year. They can be done at a variety of time scales, all the way from 10 seconds up to the lifetime of the experiment, which has already run almost for a decade. And it can be done on multiple sources. Okay, so there's a whole zoo of data that we're going to be able to bring to bear on the astrophysics and gravitational physics of these kinds of objects. Black hole at the center of our galaxy, and the black hole at the center of the giant elliptical in M87. Everything marked in green has already been measured. Okay, all the Stokes parameters have been measured. Stokes V is in kind of orange because it's an upper limit. All right. The only things that we've left out are closure amplitudes and the 345 gigahertz window. So the EHT, I hope I can impress upon you, is not a proposal. It's not a future experiment. It's happening now. So the current state of EHT data, the kinds of things we have access to, all come from this three-station prototypical EHT. And there we have multiple epochs of the visibility magnitudes for multiple sources, multiple epochs of closure phases for multiple sources, multiple epochs of polarization for Sagittarius Star now, and data coverage over 9 years. And today I'm going to show you some results that cover a subset of this data and a subset of the time period. Unfortunately, they're incomplete for a number of reasons. Okay, the first is observational. While this is the kind of coverage in the spatial frequency plane that we hope to achieve and will achieve next year, this is what a three-station array has bought us in the past 9 years. This is mostly aligned east-west. That's just a consequence of the array geometry. And clearly too sparse to produce an image from directly. Okay, so that means that we have to exploit non-imaging analysis techniques. We also have an incomplete theoretical picture of the sources we're looking at. Even for the black hole at the center of the Milky Way, there are grave uncertainties regarding the geometry and the dynamics of the region responsible for producing the emission we see. And that means we don't know if it's a big, thick, hot disk, or a thin, hot disk, or maybe a misaligned disk that's precessing, or maybe not even a disk at all, maybe one of these outflows. Okay, so all of these are, in principle, allowed models. On top of that, grafting these models onto the emission requires us to know how particle acceleration in these environments works, and that's something that we're woefully uncertain about. And that means we have to make use of parameterized particle distributions, which again can impact the image. And if all that sounds extraordinarily pessimistic, I agree. There's a lot of hurdles to overcome. But here I think we can take a lesson from the past decade of precision cosmology. A point that was made a number of times yesterday was that the universe turns out to be extraordinarily simple. And here's the standard six numbers taken from one of Planck's recent papers. And while that might be true, cosmological experiments are not. And here is another set of tables taken out of Planck's analysis papers that shows all the foregrounds. And in some sense, if we want to study gravity with known black holes, the astrophysics is our foreground. And how does Planck and other CMB experiments, other cosmological experiments, handle this? Well, they leverage other observations. They leverage observations in a variety of wavelength bands and a variety of types of observations. And that's exactly what the EHT is going to do. We're going to leverage the enormous amount of information that we know about prospective EHT targets, which all tend to be relatively close and relatively bright. So we know things like their spectra, we know things like their variability, we know things like their polarization properties, and their morphology at other wavelengths. And leveraging that enormous context is what's going to enable us to make progress, even in this rather uncertain situation. And so in the remainder of this talk, I want to give you some examples about how we've already done this, how we're working on this, and how we're going to do this to get at precision tests of strong gravity. And the first is really dealing with an existential crisis for the EHT. For something named an event horizon telescope, you really want to make sure that there are event horizons out there. Otherwise, we're going to have to rename it. And luckily, the EHT has provided the best evidence to date that that's true. And importantly, you know, if I talk to astronomers about this, they're usually terribly surprised. What do you mean black holes don't exist? Because we've all been trained to think if it's small enough and massive enough, general relativity tells us the conclusion is foregone. We have no choice. It's a black hole. But that's really a potential failure of imagination, not an empirical proof. And we can do better. So the first thing is, you know, this is in some sense a test of gravity, a qualitative test of general relativity, but of course not just general relativity. Horizons exist in other theories of gravity as well. And really, we can't prove a teleological horizon that extends off to infinity. We're really constraining alternatives to a surface of no return, where no is defined in a standard astrophysical sense, no over timescales accessible to astronomers. Okay. And the story behind this is really no more complicated than an undergraduate thermodynamics experiment. You drop a bag of rice, and if it misses the table, all the kinetic energy stays in the bag and it keeps on going. But if you drop it on the table, at some point it stops, it heats up. If you stick a thermometer in there, you can actually show your class that you've converted energy from kinetic energy in the motion to heat in the rice. And sometimes that can be an enormous amount of energy. Just go visit Arizona. Now, you might worry that black holes are complicated. They're much more complicated than bags of rice. Especially with the standard astrophysical models, we have magnetic fields. Surely we can balance things just so to prevent the rice from ever landing on our table. Something like this, where magnetic fields hold the gas out, so whatever I replace my black hole with is safe. It turns out you can't do that. Instabilities will always allow an appreciable amount of material to leak on through. And if we replace the black hole with something that has a photosphere that we can see, that doesn't have a surface of no return, it will heat and shine. And this is seen. If you look at neutron star X-ray binaries, they are typically brighter than their black hole counterparts because of the surface emission in a boundary layer onto the neutron star. Now, in the case of neutron stars, we know where to look for this emission because of the baryonic physics associated with the neutron star atmospheres. But once you've decided to take the black hole, say, at the center of the Milky Way, and replace it with something else, you've already made choices about how exotic you're going to be. Maybe you don't want to assume there's baryonic atmospheres. Nevertheless, the very first science result from the EHT was a dramatic constraint on the size of these objects. And that has critical implications for that kind of argument. For both Sagittarius Star, the galactic center, and for M87, the size is about 40 microarcseconds. Notably, that's smaller than the projected size of the horizon. So we're already seeing sub-horizon scale structures. And that small size means that if I were going to replace the black hole with something that's not a horizon, something that doesn't have a surface of no return, gravity is going to bottle it up and turn it into a perverse inside-out version of a black body cavity. Most photons that leave the high redshift surface lens around and impact the black hole, so impact the object on another side. And we know what the spectrum of a black body cavity is, independent of what it's constructed of. It always comes out thermal. And so once you know that the emission has to be thermalized, you can predict what frequency and what luminosity that surface emission has to be. And it turns out it peaks in the infrared and the optical for both M87 and Sagittarius A star. So if you supplement these EHD size limits with observations of the infrared flux and the infrared and optical flux for those two objects, you can rule out this surface emission to any significance that you like. So I think it's safe to say that at least two horizons exist, not two objects that are too massive to be anything else. Two horizons exist, modulo fine print, that I'd be happy to talk to you about, but I think all of these are tooth fairies even more extreme than deciding to do away with black holes. So already the EHT has started to make fundamental statements about gravity. The next example has to do with high-energy astrophysics. Okay, how do we leverage our theoretical understanding of how accretion flows work onto black holes, like the one at the center of our galaxy, to try to interpret EHT observations? Okay, one of the wonderful things about this conference is I discovered that I'm really a blackboard physicist. All this time, I thought I was a computational astrophysicist, but I go up to the space room, and here are these two beautiful chalk art pictures of an image of a black hole and an image of a accretion flow onto a black hole. So I thought that was brilliant, so thank you for that. Now I feel like I really belong. So the kind of accretion flow that we imagine is appropriate for sources like Sagittarius A star, these radiatively inefficient accretion flows, it's big, thick, hot donuts, not thin, cool pancakes. Okay, and the key thing about that is there's a large scale height, okay? So that impacts the shape of the image just because you have a big, big, thick emission region. The morphology of the image is fairly simple to understand then. The first most striking feature is the shadow. It's this ring created by the strong lensing of photons about the black hole. Then we have an approaching side that's optically thick. Shape is dictated by the details of the accretion flow. And much brighter because of Doppler beaming. There's a receding side, which is dimmer and optically thin. And in a nutshell, that's what an image from one of these radiatively inefficient accretion flows looks like. That's why it looks a little different than the pictures that were in Interstellar. You can tell this is a North American black hole because it's coming on the left side and going on the right side. We could also make British black holes just by time reversal, and in fact, that's something we do in our analysis. If you want to go beyond chalk art, unfortunately, we're going to need computers. And nevertheless, we can produce libraries of model images. And those libraries of model images are constrained to fit the spectrum, polarization properties, and especially important, the mass and the distance inferred by stellar dynamics observations, watching stars as they orbit the black hole at the center of our galaxy. Okay. So these are not totally free. They're already constrained by a dramatic amount or substantial amount of prior information about this source, leveraging that empirical context, which when combined with our theoretical understandings of what such an accretion flow should look like, provides us with an image map that depends on just three parameters relating to the vector spin, a magnitude and two orientations. And now we can start taking this and go compare to the raw millimeter VLBI data and ask which sets of parameters make sense, if any. And so the first thing, let's talk about orientation. Unfortunately, there's a degeneracy associated with projection. It's hard to tell the difference between a disk projected or facing towards us and a projected disk facing away from us. So that gives us two islands in inclination. But other than that, we actually have a fairly good constraint on the orientation. And each one of these are the 1 sigma, 2 sigma, and 3 sigma contours about them. And right away, we can say what this could be correlated with and what it's certainly not correlated with. So for example, it is absolutely not correlated with the axis of rotation of the galaxy. Much larger scales. Should have nothing to do with what's going on down near the black hole, and indeed it doesn't. It's not correlated with what's happening even out at 3 parsecs, which is still infinitely far away in units of the black hole gravitational radius. It's not correlated with any of those nearby stars, which are completely thermalized and have random orbits. But it is correlated with the infrared gas clouds that have recently made a big splash as they zipped around the black hole on nearly radial orbits and are thought to be the remnants of a tidally disrupted molecular cloud. And they are aligned with the clockwise disk of stars, which have a lot of very young, very massive stars that are blowing off powerful winds that are believed to be responsible for sourcing the accretion flow onto the galactic center. So we can already say that our spin estimates produce directions that are correlated with the things you might guess they should be and uncorrelated with the things that they shouldn't be. We can also go look at the spin magnitudes. This is a three-dimensional parameter space, so it's complicated to look at. Let's focus in on just one panel. The first thing that I see when I look at this is mostly blue. Okay, we already have fairly tight constraints. How tight? Well, here's our one sigma model family. So these are images taken from the one sigma contour in our fit space. It takes me a few moments to tell they're different, but I promise you they all are. So that's how constraining the 7 years of data already is. And that means that we've reached a surprising conclusion, that a very simple and single accretion flow model has been able to successfully fit multiple epochs, extending over 7 years, of data of multiple types. And that's a highly non-trivial statement, which suggests that this model is, you know, onto something. I'm not sure if I'm excited about this or I'm depressed by this. You know, I kind of hoped that we would find unexpected things already, but success is okay. That's not to say that it was easy. Here's a picture of the closure phase measurements. The only thing I want you to walk away from this with is the idea that it certainly isn't stationary. The closure phases do not have a fixed value over the entire sets of observations. And in fact, from day to day, they do vary quite a bit. In fact, they vary at significance greater than 5 sigma, so I think you can say we've actually detected fluctuations in the closure phases. And that would suggest, or seem to belie the conclusion I just tried to sell you, that a single model seems to fit, except that this variability was expected. It was expected because to see the galactic center, we have to look through the galactic plane. And while the closure phases are specifically constructed so that we don't have seeing from the atmosphere, we can't avoid seeing from the galactic plane. So this is sort of like stars twinkling in the interstellar plasma. And what's being shown here is an annulus image through a refracting screen that passes by. It's essentially just like stellar twinkling. And this imparts small-scale structure to the image, and that small-scale structure has the right amplitude to reproduce the fluctuations we see. And we can measure that. This has been normalized against longer frequency observations and has a very specific wavelength dependence. So we can actually determine how much of this fluctuation should be from the scintillation. And it turns out, within a factor of 2, all of it is. So that's good. We know about it. We can mitigate it. We can effectively implement an adaptive optics scheme in the analysis and remove it. Except you might start to be worried, because now we're running into a budget issue. This is not the only way to get small-scale structure in the image. The other way is MHD turbulence. And this MHD turbulence is absolutely critical to our story of accretion. It's the MHD turbulence that produces the magnetic fields that drive the stresses that drive accretion. Okay, without those magnetic fields, there is no inflow. And so if this accounts for all the small-scale structure, where is that? And I think the coming few years are going to be about trying to calibrate our small-scale structure budget and eke out the first evidence on horizon scales of MHD turbulence driving accretion. We can, of course, also look for much longer timescale variability. Okay, this is variability not on minutes and hours, but variability on weeks to decades. And you might expect this being driven by lens theorem precession. Now, this is somewhat different than Bardeen-Peterson precession because we have a thick disk, and thick disks are strongly viscously coupled. So the whole disk rigidly precesses around, and that's shown in this nice simulation by Chris Fagill nearly a decade ago that shows the whole disk dance around in precession. And that will produce a wobble in the image, And we can go look for that wobble, a systematic change in the orientation of the image. And the short version is we don't see it. This looks like this is starting to constrain misaligned disk models fairly strongly. Okay, there's this obnoxious forest of high probability. These are all below 2 sigma, but nevertheless, this forest of high probability associated with harmonics of 1 year, that's a consequence of the observing schedule of the Event Horizon Telescope. It always seems to look in the same one-month period every year. As soon as the signal-to-noise ratios improve, or there's an observation outside of that one-month window, those go away, and we can essentially eliminate all precession periods below a decade or a couple decades. So I hope you've walked away from that thinking that maybe we have a handle on the astrophysics, at least in this one object. Clearly, there's work to be done. But if you begin to have confidence in our theoretical models for accretion flows, then we can start removing them. We can start excluding them as the foregrounds that they are, and go after the space-time structure itself. And so for the remainder, let me give you 4 cases where we can do that. So the first is we can just take a ruler and drop it on the image and measure the angular size. And you can tell I'm a theorist because my ruler measures things in gravitational radii, as opposed to centimeters. But you know, this is very simple. You know, there's no statistical magic here. Straight up, just measure the angular scale of the size of that shadow. And that gives you a measurement of the mass divided by the distance. And we can start putting together constraints in the mass-distance plane for Sagittarius A star, the first being things like masers. So these are straight-up parallax measurements of masers near the galactic center. There's also the dynamics of those stars that's provided the best mass estimates to date. And that gives us some other line. There's also information in the structure and dynamics of the nuclear star clusters. So these are stars that you don't see making full orbits, but only partial orbits. And you can constrain something about the gravitational potential from those. And cutting across all of those would be this angular size measurement from the EHT. Of course, you can combine all those and get a much better mass and distance estimate. But I think the real value of this should be thought of in comparison or an analogy to the binary pulsar test of gravity, where you have many ways of measuring a combination of the masses of the two stars, and they all have to cross at one location if general relativity is right. The same thing is true here. Many different ways of measuring the distance, combinations of the distance and the mass, but they all have to cross at one location, with the one substantial difference that the EHT line is a strong gravity measurement, because it happens due to lensing in the immediate vicinity of the black hole. So right off the bat, we can do precision strong field tests, just with a ruler. To do better than this, we have to define clearly what we're going after. And you know, the paraphrased version of the no-hair theorems is that black holes are simple, characterized by only a few numbers. But in astrophysics, really only one. Mass sets a scale, electric charge is unimportant, and the difference between space-times are entirely determined by spin. And so if you can measure this one number in a bunch of different ways, you can potentially look for other knobs that you need to specify in order to completely determine the space-time. And we've tried to do that by using phenomenological deformed metrics. So we simply add terms to the Kerr metric that don't change the mass, don't change the angular momentum, but do change higher-order moments like the quadrupole. And that results in black holes that look sort of like peanut M&Ms, classical M&Ms, and of course, that's just a black hole. Okay, so squished in different orientations, and that produces changes in the images that you can try to constrain. And in January of last year, we published the first analysis of this. It was really a proof of concept that you could do this, and it uses data only up to 2009. Recently, this has been updated using data all the way up to 2013, and we are starting to exclude order unity deviations. So that's really exciting. We're already starting to say deep things about the structure of the space-time. But as soon as ALMA and the LMT and the South Pole Telescope are in the array, we're talking about sub-percent tests. Now, I don't for a moment believe that the astrophysical systematic errors are going to permit this. I think that this is a sign that the onus is now on the theorists to prove that we understand the accretion theory. And so there's a lot of work now to be done in determining exactly what the astrophysical systematics are going to be and how to eliminate them. But the era of precision, strong gravity, I think, is upon us. Yet another way we might try to go after the space-time again returns us to this variable closure phase. Now, some of you might have noticed that one of these points did not look like the others, and indeed, that point is notably discrepant. It's in fact a 3-sigma outlier. And 3-sigma is enough to start getting nervous, not enough to be sure, but enough to start getting nervous. And it turns out this too was expected. Because about once a day, Sagittarius A star flares, suddenly gets brighter and then dims back down. And this happens in the infrared, and it happens in the X-rays, and it happens in the millimeter. And on that day, the galactic center was flaring. Now, the really interesting thing about this is that the closure phases are incredibly sensitive to the structure of the image. And so a sudden deviation in the closure phases means that associated with that flare was a structural change in the emission region. It didn't just get brighter, it changed. And in fact, it didn't change arbitrarily. You can ask, if I were to add another component, where must it have been? And the answer is, almost uniquely, it had to look something like this. Okay, hot spots in an accretion flow, popping off and decaying down, are almost the unique solution. Okay, there's a couple other things that you might try, but a jet in a disk or an overall brightening, a spot in a jet or an overall brightening are absolutely ruled out. And this is very promising because it opens the door to doing space-time tomography. These spots move around, they light up different regions of the space-time. Because they're compact, they eliminate the degeneracy between when a photon was emitted and where along the line of sight it was emitted. And since they happen once a day, you can go catch many of them. And as you watch many spots pop off, you can map out different locations in the space-time. And importantly, this is totally independent of the kind of multipolar quiescent disk analysis that I mentioned before. It has a totally different set of systematics and provides a check on any conclusions that are reached there. Now, because these spots pop off and move around on timescales of 30 minutes, we're not going to be able to produce movies that quite look like that for Sag A star. But we can do non-imaging analyses and look for fluctuations in the closure phase. And the kind of thing that we could do last year looked something like this. So it was a lot of bouncing around some systematic fluctuations. But this is what we're going to be able to do next year. We're going to be able to map out the structure of the hotspot orbit, the change in the morphology of the emission region in closure phases, and therefore properties of the space-time. And in fact, we'll do quite a bit better than this as the specifications of the EHT have improved. We also have recently developed the capability to detect polarization. And this has dramatic implications for how we can go after these spots because they look very different in total intensity and the polarized intensity. Okay? In the polarized images, they're almost completely dominated by the spot emission. There is some quiescent emission. It maybe it should be a little bit brighter than it is seen here. But certainly, the hot spots should be very differently polarized. And so you could imagine measuring the location of the spots in the polarized image relative to the location of the quiescent accretion flow in the unpolarized image. And in fact, you can do exactly that. And you can reconstruct the location of that hotspot, and therefore its orbit, with exquisite accuracy by comparing the two. Okay? And with that, measure, again, the structure of the space-time for each spot that you see. And so that's a third way that we can get at space-time structure directly. Now, there's an enormous amount of work to be done. Okay, there's a great deal of astrophysics to settle, the apparatus to actually run all of these analyses and understand the systematic errors have to be fully developed. And to do that, the Perimeter Institute has launched the Event Horizon Telescope Initiative. If you're interested and excited by this, would like to come participate, please get in touch with me. If you know excellent young people graduate students and postdocs who you think would be interested, please send them our way. We need all the help we can get. And finally, you know, just to put all this in perspective, where are we now when we talk about strong gravity? Here's this iconic pale blue dot image, right? The first time we see the world as a single pixel, we remind ourselves we're all in this together. And I'd like to think that as soon as we have an image like this, this will be the beginning of the 21st century's version of the pale blue dot, maybe with a more sinister connotation. We're not all in this together, but there are monsters lurking in the dark. But on a brighter note, it's going to herald the beginning of the era of empirical strong gravity research, because not only is the EHT developing at this time, but we heard yesterday about the ability of gravitational wave observatories to unlock the dark side of the universe. And together, I think, we're going to learn a great deal about gravity that we never knew before. Thank you.
Thank you, Avery. We have time for questions. So for the questions, please wait for the microphone and remember to hold it closely.
Hi, Avery. So you said next year you're going to be starting observations at a higher frequency, shorter wavelength, and that should improve both the scattering problem and allow resolution of finer detail. Now, how far do you think you can go in that direction?
So high frequency is wonderful, except for the problem that the atmosphere is quickly not cooperating. So at 230 gigahertz, at a good site, and these are the highest, driest sites in the world, you get most of the days of the year you can do astronomy. At 345, I think it cuts down dramatically to maybe half the year or even less. There are windows at 690, and there's even a window up near a terahertz. But there, getting more than one site with good weather is probably hard enough that you're going to have trouble getting that beyond time allocation committees. So I think 345 is really the limit until, you know, budgets suddenly swell. We could imagine doing this in space or something, but that's a different scale problem. That said, there's an enormous amount at 230 you can do, because these sources are almost entirely optically thin. So going to much higher frequency buys you some resolution, but that's it.
Could you comment a bit more on the measurement of the spin? So what do we know already about the spin of Psi J star? I didn't pay enough attention on that side. How can EHT improve it? What's the situation?
So the spin estimates have been steadily improving but remain upper limits. So I think it's safe to say that, at least from the analyses we've done, Psi J star has got a spin less than a half at fairly high significance. Okay. Our best estimate spin value is formally non-zero now, so I was very excited about that, but we can't rule out zero. This does hold together with that broader story I mentioned, the lack of precession and the alignment between the spin and in our case, therefore, the accretion disk angular momentum vector, and the sources of the accretion all point to the same conclusion, that the spin of Psi J star can't be terribly large. How is it going to improve? Well, as soon as we have images like this, you know, if I increase the spin dramatically, I change the balance of light in this picture. It becomes much more dominated by this oncoming region, just because orbits are faster. Okay, it also changes the shape of the shadow. So as signal-to-noise improves, we'll be able to map that out as well. So I fully expect we're going to get very good spin measurements. But that's for the future.
So we have time for one more question. So let's thank Avery again.